And tonight on Coast to Coast, two special guests with a very special message. Whitley Strieber, of course, the supernatural, along with Jeffrey Kripal. Jeffrey was on with us about a year and a half ago. And we'll be back with both of them talking about a new vision of the unexplained next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Whitley Strieber, of course, with us. Whitley is the author of many best-selling novels and works of fiction and nonfiction. Four movies have been made from his books. Among his best-known novels, of course, The Wolfen, The Hunger, of course, Alien Hunter. And now we're talking with Whitley about the supernatural. Whitley, I can't wait to get into this, especially the title. And welcome back, my friend.
Well, it's always good to be here, George. And, yeah, a new vision of the unexplained is what we've come to.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. And, of course, Jeffrey Kripal holds the J. Newton Rezaud Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University. He's also the chairperson of the Department of Religious Studies, and his present area of interest include erotics of mystical literature and so much more. And here he is as well with the book The Supernatural. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, George. It's good to be on.
Hey, I loved your story and book about sitting next to people who always ask what you do.
Right. I have a little section there entitled What to Say on a Plane. It's a constant challenge. Because what I do doesn't have any common category in the public mind or public culture, so I'm always having to explain myself.
You know, I'm the same way. I'm on a plane and somebody will always say, so what do you do? And then that opens up the floodgates.
Right.
It is. Well, Whitley, yeah,
when they ask me that question, it can get scary. And Jeff, I've often wondered what you do. I've tried to figure that ever since we became collaborators. But what he did do was enable me to get into some very new stuff, things that I have kept inside myself and never written about in 30 years, but with an academic to bring perspective, it's suddenly possible to do a lot more than I've ever done before.
You know, Whitley, I've known you for years, but I have never known you in a writing or otherwise to be so aggressively critical, and that's in a good way, about who you are and what you've done. And, I mean, some of the thoughts and the questions of, you know, people call you a liar and what you have to do to combat that, and it's amazing. You literally have taken off the gloves this time.
Well, I have, because it's, you know, it's time. I've been doing this for 30 years, and during that time, I've seen a lot of change in the public. When I started out, it was not easy. But people have gradually, in part through my work, but also just because of what we see around us and what happens to our friends and often to us, people have become much more open-minded about the unknown than they were back then. But at the same time, the scientific community is closing, and the intellectuals, a la the people like Jeff, except not Jeff, are just closing down unbelievably, to the point where it's almost as if they know something is going on, and they simply can't face it. They can't face it. And what we're saying here is, yeah, you can. You can face it. And not only face it, we've got the academic skills and the scientific tools to really understand this stuff. Like, is it alien contact or something else? And if it's something else, what in the world is it? That just fascinates me. I've been face-to-face with this for a long time.
Sure have.
And done so much. I've had a really weird life. And, you know, I'd really like to have, before I go on to the great beyond, I'd like to have an answer.
You also sound stronger now than I've heard you in some time.
Before. Yeah, because I'm, you know, a lot of water's passed under the bridge. I've lost Annie, which everybody listening to this show knows. My wife died in August. And when something like that, something so huge happens to you, someone who was such a deep companion, you either you're going to find your strength or you are not. You're going to drown. And I made a decision. I'm going to find my strength and go on. That's what she would want. If I show up early, she's going to be furious.
Oh, she'll send you back.
Send me back. Darn right.
Now, tell me, if you would, Whitley, and we're going to bring Jeffrey in, about the collaboration on this work, The Supernatural. How did that happen? How long has it been going on?
Jeff, you start.
Well, I first read Whitley in 2009, not all that long ago. I was working on a book called Mutants and Mystics, which is on the paranormal experiences of writers and artists who produce science fiction and film. And I read Communion, of course, and I was deeply impressed with the way Whitley reflected on his experiences in the book and really did not land prematurely on any particular answer. He wrote like scholars of religion write. He displayed all the sophistication and nuance that I saw among my peers in the profession. And so I contacted Whitley actually through a mutual friend and editor, Mitch Horowitz.
Oh, no, and Mitch, I was just with him this weekend, Jeffrey, doing our Beyond Belief television program in Denver.
Oh, great. Well, Mitch really is the connector piece here, and he put me in touch with Whitley, and I sent Whitley the chapter that I had written on him for Mutants and Mystics, and that sort of generated the conversation and eventual friendship. And then I invited Whitley and Ann a number of times to the Esalen Institute, where I'm an active symposium leader.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so, you know, it's been 6-7 years now of conversation and correspondence and friendship, and I think our conversation has really deepened over the years, and this book really came out of that friendship and that collaboration.
Whitley, in the book, there's discussions of owl sightings. What's the significance of that?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I was talking on Dreamland. In fact, it's on this week with a guy, Mike Cleland, who has actually written a book about the relationship between owls and owl sightings and the close encounter experience. And there is a connection of some sort. And I thought to myself, and I wrote about this in the book, that maybe it's kind of like a language. Because if you look at the way an owl lives, he's a creature of the night. He's very mysterious. He surprises his prey very expertly. An owl can even hear and target animals in burrows under the ground. I mean, obviously, if not if they're real deep, but you know, if they think they're safe, they can go down and pull them right out of their burrow. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah, darn right it does. And yet, at the same time that the owl is a predator, he's also a symbol of knowledge. And you know, when I was a little boy, there was an owl that used to stand in our backyard in the early morning hours, really bothered my parents.
They look human.
Well, they do, kind of. It bothered my parents a lot, to the point where they nailed my window shut. And, of course, speaking of owls, guess who works at a university whose mascot is
the owl?
Jeff Kripal.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're owled in here.
Yeah, I'm surrounded by owls. I walk by and under owls every day of my life at the university.
Who designed the cover? The cover's an eye of an owl, isn't it?
The eye of an owl, yeah. That's Mitch Horowitz.
Okay.
Mitch came up with that fabulous cover, and it's really a great cover.
I swear, you look at it, you think it's going to blink.
Well, they thought about making it so it would blink, but it was too expensive.
Yeah, I told Mitch we needed one of those plastic credit card effects.
Yeah.
It blinks to move it.
All right, let's get into the work, the supernatural. And for you, Jeff, I'm fascinated by the fact that the words are separate, supernatural. They're not put together as one. How come?
Well, I invented I used this phrase in a textbook I wrote a couple of years ago. It was actually the last time I was on Coast to Coast was for this textbook on how to compare religions, which is probably the first textbook on the market to include a whole chapter on the paranormal. And I used the phrase the supernatural in that work to explain how historically human beings have encountered what they perceive to be divinity or a god or something sacred in and through and as the natural world. Historically, human communities did not separate what we think of as the supernatural one word from nature. It was all a piece for them, and there was no distinction. They thought of a god or a spirit as very much of an intimate part of their environment. And so we decided to call the book The Supernatural, three words, to carry this basic theme in the book, which I think is very faithful to Whitley's book, that when someone has a paranormal encounter, it's part of our natural world. It's just a part of our natural world that we don't understand or have any kind of scientific model for. And so that's really the core idea of the book, is that.
And Whitley, do you find that doing Dreamland and just your own experiences, that these strange things that have happened to all of us that we've been aware of, reported on, abduction reports, ghost sightings, and so much more, are they becoming more and more prevalent?
Yeah, they definitely are. I think that people are beginning to notice there's more to the world around them than they were willing to look at. Say it's back in the 50s. You weren't supposed to see this stuff. It wasn't supposed to exist. You go back 100 years, and people were noticing all kinds of things because no one was telling them not to. Now, there's this science is telling us increasingly we are just meat puppets. We're machines made out of meat, and that's it. And when you die, you're gone. Forget it. And people are beginning to think, well, wait a minute, that's not how my life experience is. If that's true, then what did I see standing in front of my closet last night? See what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're really not buying into it. And we shouldn't, because it's not true. We are a little physical part of the world racing through time, embedded in an enormous, timeless reality that is conscious, and we have no idea of what it is at all.
And Jeffrey, as you look at this through the perspective of, I'm not going to call you a theologian, but you're an expert in religious studies and religion. How did that all happen for you?
How did what happen? How did I become a scholar of religion?
Yeah, your interest in that.
Well, so I'm a historian of religions, and most people would think of that as someone who does comparative religion. I compare things, and what I compare is people's extreme religious experiences across time and across cultures, with the understanding or the goal that if we compare these sorts of experiences over a long period of time and do that with enough precision, that we'll begin to understand the underlying mechanisms or the underlying nature of that which we're comparing. In other words, we'll come to a better understanding of ourselves and our place in the cosmos.
Well, we've got to get you back for another program, Jeffrey, to talk about the Shiites and the Shia and why they continue to battle, and the Sunnis, why they continue to battle.
I don't know if I'm, I'm not an expert on Islam, but there are lots of people like that in my field who could speak to that. So that's what I do. I mean, I think about how different religious communities compare one another. And of course, often they compare one another very poorly. They're not fair to the other religious community. So that's a part of what I do. But I'm really most interested in these sorts of extreme or anomalous events and what they tell us about ourselves. And I came to that through a long circuitous route, which is probably not relevant in this context,
right.
But I've written about it extensively in my books.
And Whitley, our mutual colleague Stephen Bassett is hot on the trail of hoping that Hillary Clinton is going to be, if she becomes the Democratic nominee and if she ends up running, being the president, hopes that she will blow the lid off of UFOs.
She said she would get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, what
she
do you think of
that?
She
didn't say she'd disclose anything.
That's right. And I still don't think government will, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I go back with this a long way, and I've had contacts or experience, or I'd say not extensive, but contacts with people in the government from time to time. Certainly General Exon talked a lot to me about this. Just for those of you who don't know, my uncle Mickey was an Air Force intelligence officer, and he was involved directly in the Roswell incident, and so was his commander, his General Arthur Exon, who was not a general in 1947, but eventually became a general and became the commander of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Okay, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and they talked to me a lot about that. General Exon said in no uncertain terms, everyone from Truman on down knew that what we'd found was not of this world within 24 hours of our finding.
But they won't tell us that.
But they won't tell us that. And why not? And here's what I think it is. I don't think they know to this day exactly what they found. I get that strong impression. I know close encounter witnesses who have been involved in studies that were run by government entities, not me. I would never go down that path personally. I've got too much baggage. I'm not so sure. It might be turn out to be a roach motel for me. So I've never done that, but I do know. And if they're still right now trying to figure this out, well, you can understand why they're not going to say anything. Because, you know, I always hear people say, well, what they should do is just admit that some of the lights in the sky may be intelligently controlled.
Right.
And I think to myself, okay, say NASA says that. 2 days later, there are reporters asking the president, what about the abductions? And no matter how you cut it, that's where it's going
to
go.
And then they have to explain how they've denied for so many years. Whitley, we're going to come back with you, Jeffrey, as well in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the supernatural. And we're back with Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal as we're talking about their new work, The Supernatural, which you can find it on Amazon.com. It is there. And Whitley, we were talking about disclosure. I wanted you to finish up on what you were talking about.
Yeah. So I think the problem is that they don't know enough. General Exon told me that until 1963, I believe he said, when he became head of Wright-Patt, he was the liaison between the Air Force and the scientific committee that was studying this whole subject. And there's no record of such a committee, and nor is there any record of any Air Force liaison like that in the public record. But it happened, apparently. Why would he have lied? I mean, he didn't lie, and neither did my uncle. They had no reason to, and they wouldn't just call me up and lie to me like that, and they didn't. I'm sure they were telling the truth.
Sure.
What the reasons were is another question. I don't know the answer to that question. maybe my uncle was so closed mouthed that it's hard for me to believe that he wasn't asked to open this door crack. Because in his entire life, I don't think even his family knew very much about what his personal family knew very much about what he did. I certainly didn't. But here's where we are right now, I think. We've got something very extensive going on that the public can't be told about. You know, the most haunting thing happened last May when George H.W. Bush slipped and when he was asked about the UFO situation, mm-hmm. and he said, the public's not ready. The public's not ready. For what? Well, if it's anything like what happened to me, yeah, I would agree. Who's ready for that? I had the most wonderful and the most difficult experience life. It's been my life. I mean, I have had this stuff happen to me even as recently as just a year ago. And, you know, when you read Supernatural, there's a whole evolution of this thing since Communion. I mean, it's a whole new experience for me. It never really ended. Now, is that the way we are all going to live, or supposed to live? And what are we? What are they? Are they part of us, or are they really aliens from another planet? I don't know the answers to those questions.
Yeah. Are they time travelers? Who knows?
Yeah, Anne thought they were. Anne thought that's exactly what they were, and she had good reason to think so.
They were us.
Very interesting reason that if you travel back in time, you have a great deal of trouble changing things, because the principle of least action will always prevent the grandfather paradox from happening. You can't kill your own grandfather. In fact, you can't do anything that changes your world unless maybe you trick the past into believing you are something other than what you are.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that's what it was. Maybe it is. Maybe they are us disguised in order to trick their past in such a way that they can make changes. It's a wild theory, but every theory about this is wild. Every theory, it has to be. Ain't it fun? I think it's just great fun.
We're going to get into some specifics in the book, The Supernatural, starting with you, Jeffrey, too. You talk about bilocation, which, of course, is the ability of being in the same place, two different places at the same time. You know somebody that this happened to?
Well, no, I think we're confusing bilocation and teleportation. I tell the story of a good friend of mine who had an experience in his kitchen of a teleporting object, in this case, a honey jar.
Okay.
But a bilocation is something that's actually quite common in what we call hagiographical literature. In other words, stories about saints. And, you know, it's well attested in these historical documents, really up to and including through the 20th century. And often the bilocating individual isn't entirely aware that he or she is bilocating, but he or she is seen at another location in some kind of physical or quasi-physical form. That's part of the religious literature that we look at and study and try to understand these other sorts of experiences.
Of the stories that you encountered, Jeffrey, or have investigated, or simply wrote on, which one is probably one of your favorites?
You mean in the book?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Well, there's a lot of stories in the book we tell. I mean, Whitley's stories, of course, are among my favorites, but they're probably best left to Whitley to tell. I'm very much attracted to this story of one of my colleagues who was making actually muffins in his kitchen, and set a honey jar on the counter after he used it. He had to wash it off. It got honey all over it, as they often do. And he walked across the kitchen to get the flour tin, and as he pulled the tin off the shelf, it suddenly got very heavy and dropped to the floor. And there in the flour was the honey jar that he had just washed. And he looked across the room, and it was gone. And it had somehow popped out of existence on the counter and popped back into existence in the flour tin. For what reasons, he has absolutely no idea. But it happened. It happened in broad daylight. He was not smoking anything. He was not in any kind of altered state. It was just a fact of his experience. And it's a witness to how incredibly strange even physical reality is, and often behaves as such. And so I think we can take experiences like that and kind of speculate out of them, you know, back to other historical cases or forward to some of Whitley's experiences, which often involve the strange behavior of physical objects.
And Whitley, in your case, I mean, you have gone through some incredible things, but you've also gone through some heated, I'm not going to say accusations, but there's that camp out there that says, oh, he's making all this stuff up. This didn't happen to him. How do you handle that?
You know, that's been always been a problem because, you know, I have to admit, if you look at my whole life, it does not add up. This is not a normal life. It just isn't. Not even too many abductees have had lives this weird. I do know some. I will, in my own defense, say that I'm not the weirdest of the weird. I'm up there in the...
You're up there. You're
definitely
pretty...
up in the higher levels of that particular committee.
You're in the top 5% for sure.
Probably so. And the answer is, I just don't know. I can say this. People can, you know, they can look at a 30-year career of a guy who has been talking about this, who won't shut up. And I'm not going to shut up because something happened. And, you know, people are, he's just telling a lie. We're better than that. Most people are more perceptive than that. And
you're beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, they can see that I believe it. And I have lots of reasons to say that something happened. All I have to do is touch my ear, where this implant we've talked about on Coast many times.
Still there.
And I, you know, Annie told me to leave it there, and she was right, because, goodness, I'm a person who will push all of this away. But I'd love to push it all away. I'd love to explain it away, not just explain it and say, well, it really is aliens, or it really is this, or it really is that, but to explain it away and say it's really all just nothing. All I have to do is touch the implant, and it reminds me it is very far from nothing.
Well, let's bring Jeff in for a minute, Whitley, and just get his thoughts on what he thinks about you.
Well, George, let me speak to the earlier question, because I think it hits the answer to what I think of Whitley. I mean, so one of the things I do in the book is I bring the tools of the study of religion to bear on Whitley's experiences. And I do that because, oddly enough, or naturally enough, the comparison normalizes Whitley. He ceases to be quite so strange. For example, his encounters with short humanoids and his erotic encounters with this feminine being, and even the implant, all of those have very clear analogs in the history of religions, in other cultures and other times. And so by looking at those other cases in different cultures and different religions, what happens is Whitley's experiences cease to be anecdotal, which is the main strategy of the debunkers. They want to pretend that someone like Whitley is either making it up or his experiences are so singular that they mean nothing.
Right.
But in fact, when you place them in the context of comparative religion, they're quite familiar, and there are thousands and thousands of other cases that look like them, not quite like them, but they look like them. And so the end result is that Whitley's experiences might not make sense to us in our own worldview at this moment, but they're actually quite common in the history of human civilization. And human beings have found these deeply meaningful and have formed whole religions and civilizations out of them over long stretches of time. So they cease to be anecdotal and become very, very important.
Whitley, you've been at this a long time. It bothered you, I think, somewhat in the beginning, but not anymore.
Well, it did, yeah. You know, you wake up in a what appeared to be a tent full of gigantic insects, and they're going after you. You are bothered. I was real bothered that night, I have to admit. But at the same time, along with all of the rough treatment and the challenge to my marriage even that occurred, came knowledge, incredible knowledge. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it was beyond belief. It was like I got let out of the barnyard or something. It was, and they found this whole big world out there that some of us sense is there, others of us know is there, and we are being told every day of our lives by the media, by our scientific community, by our intellectuals, is not there, but it is there. And it's quite incredible. I wouldn't say it was, oh, wonderful. It wasn't like going to heaven.
Right.
It was like being a little creature in a very big and unexplainable world. It was pretty dangerous, I think, and pretty amazing.
Have you ever been threatened?
In what sense?
By people because of what has happened to you?
Oh, sure. Many times. Once there were some guys doing some work at our cabin, pulling some poison ivy out of some trees. And all of a sudden, this foreman of the group walks up to the house and says, "We're quitting." I said, "Okay, you want to be paid off?" He said, "No, we don't want any money. We don't want your money," he says. One of those aliens walked across your driveway. It was a long driveway. And then these black snakes came up out of the ground, and we don't have those snakes around here, and we don't want to be here anymore. We're leaving.
Wow.
And so they left. I mean, you can understand that. I didn't argue with them. I would have left too.
Had they known about you before this?
I don't know. Not really. I mean, sort of. The local people kind of did.
Yeah.
But after that,
that was it for them.
Things changed because word got around. The next thing I knew, I got a phone call from this very uneasy lady during hunting season, saying, "Be careful, because someone's planning to accidentally shoot you."
Uh-oh.
During hunting season. And so, you know, I didn't go out. I couldn't. And it became like the house became like a kind of fortress. I was nervous even going to the grocery store, to tell you the truth. People get scared. And when they're scared, they become unreasonable. I am a person who does not scare easily, obviously. I mean, I wouldn't have said that about myself before any of this happened, but look at what I've gone through. No, I don't scare very easily, obviously. And in fact, I kind of find fear kind of fascinating. I guess that's why I used to write Arnold.
Whitley, while you were collaborating with Jeffrey and putting this work together, was Anne any part of this, or could she have been?
Oh, she was a huge part of it. Annie was pretty sick when this book was being written, but that didn't mean her mind was turned off at all. I'm going to read this dedication to Anne Streber. I dedicate this book to the memory of Anne Streber. We evolved our approach to the supernatural together. She contributed three foundational insights. The first is that the close encounter experience is something unknown and must be kept in question. Second, that the question must be deepened and can only be resolved by scientific and academic inquiry. It must no longer be dismissed with assumptions, beliefs, and premature theorizing. Third, after reading in excess of 200,000 testaments from the public about close encounter experiences, she was able to say with authority that close encounters with apparent aliens often include perceptions of the dead as well. It is on her rigorous questioning and tireless inquiry that my own insights depend. I think that answers your question.
It sure does.
You're darn right.
It sure does. Well, good. I'm glad she was part of this.
Wow.
Now, when you, Jeffrey, let's pop you back here for a minute, then we're going to be at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and chat more with both of you for a couple more hours. When this was, when you two were assembling this, were you, because, you know, you wrote a book called Mutants and Mystics, right? That was about superhero comics. And so you've dabbled in the paranormal before, right?
Yeah, I hope more than dabbled, but yeah.
Did this one change your views on anything in terms of your outlook on abductions or ghosts or anything? Was there any change? Did you learn something that you didn't know before?
Well, I always learned things from Whitley, but remember, I had written an entire chapter on him in the Mutants and Mystics book.
Right.
And so we had been in conversation for many years. I think the real takeaway for me from this book was a much profounder sense of humility about what we don't know, which is pretty much everything. Not that I felt like we knew something before, but it was I suppose the phenomena become more mysterious and more mind bending. Through writing this book with Whitley, because I, you know, it's as close as a counter as I've ever had. I've never had, one of these abduction experiences, although I had something like it once, but working with Whitley and meeting his mind and his heart and working with Anne and knowing her, I think Anne is a huge part of this particular story. She's the presence behind a lot of this.
Let's talk more with both of you when we come back, including a few scary stories that you had in the book.